Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. I'm Melody Cederstrom, and you're listening to Financial Survival. Today, my conversation is with James Corbett for the second and third segment of the program today. So you will hear a pre-recorded conversation from earlier this week. And just as a reminder, the reason we do this is because of the time difference, as you all know that James lives in Japan. So what we're going to do, I have a special guest that's going to join me for my first 20 minutes of fame, and I'm going to share it with a really good friend and supporter of Discount Gold and Silver. So I'm going to hold that little secret of whom he is. This is going to be like that old TV show, I guess, the game show that you had to guess who it was. But now we'll introduce him. But first, let me just get to the market report for November 1st, 2019. What about that? November 1st. And I think he's had snow in his area, but we'll talk about that. Gold today was all over the page, but we're still holding at $1,513 in the New York spot price. Aftermarket, you have silver holding at $1,817. Platinum was up $18 at $953. And palladium was up $11 at $1,816. That's $1,816. The USDX was down another 0.13, little by little, whittles some away, 97.20. Crude oil was up 1.93 at 56.11. And the paper markets today, let's see if we can get to the paper markets. Jobs report was out. I'm going to just talk about them briefly after we bring on my special guest. You had the Dow up 285 points, 27,331. The NASDAQ was up 94 points at 8,386. The S&P was up 29 at 3,066. 10-year yield, 1.73%. European Asian markets were, they were positive, but still all under 1%. Japan was a little negative. And that's pretty much everything is happy. Don't worry, be happy. But before we get and talk a little bit about the jobs report, my special guest today, and he is a good friend, and he is also a great supporter of Discount Gold and Silver, is Rob West, calling from Denver, Colorado, right? Good afternoon, Rob. Welcome.
Good afternoon, Melody. Nice to join you from snowy Colorado.
Yes. Well, better you than me, that's for sure. But one thing I will say about snow, though, there's such beauty in it, and there's that quiet, the stillness that you have when it snows. It's actually beautiful. But
come on out. We usually don't get it in October, but we were challenged with the calendaring of the first one coming in. At least I live around 6,700 feet, so we usually don't get, of course, the mountain snow. They've been skiing up there in the higher altitudes for a few weeks, maybe a month. But anyway, it's a nice place, and more people are discovering us, and they're certainly moving in.
Yes. So. As much as I enjoy it, I don't think I want to move there. But anyway, sorry, Rob. Let's just get to the jobs report real quick, because I know you want to talk about some things, and we have 15 minutes to do so. And we'll talk a little bit more about this on Monday. Jobs report created 128,000 jobs. And, of course, that easily topped the estimates. Most of the estimates were, around 75,000, 80,000. There were big revisions to the numbers as well, to past numbers as well, like August initial 168,000 payrolls addition was revised upward, and September's jumped from 136 to 180,000. The unemployment rate ticked slightly higher, 3.6% from 3.5%, but it's still near the lowest. And the pace of average hourly earnings picked up a bit, 0.1%. Don't go and spend that all in one place. Rising 0.1% to a year-over-year, looking at about a 3% gain. So we did say the only thing that was a little negative on that was, I believe, manufacturing again contracted. And see if I can find that number here quickly. If I can't, We'll talk a little bit more about it come Monday. But one thing I did see, Rob, I saw that President Trump tweeted saying that we had over 300,000, if you added in the revisions and so forth, that I just talked about for August and September. And the only thing I can say that, Mr. President, is if you add those numbers, those revisions to the upside to this month to make it a good month, then when there's revisions to the downside, you also have to do them too. You just can't take the positive all the time. You have to add in the negative when there's negative. And again, you know, of course, the stock market liked it and everything. So we're looking at these record highs once again. So again, but it's interesting, Rob, that we saw the employment rate tick to 3.6%. So
it's quite a velocity of money going around out there with employment growing, and you know, when things get tough in the economy, for those who study through concepts with your show, you know, they know they always hear the consumer is going to bail us out, because if the velocity of money means the consumers are buying and merchants are selling and people are employed, and it's quite a whirlwind, as you know.
Yes, certainly. Yeah. Is Let's move on to give you, you know, enough time. You had a particular topic that you wanted to discuss today, and you know, just make sure that we head into our break at 20 after to give us your contact info and everything before we head out. So I'm going to let you go ahead and take over.
Well, I wanted to share some things about perceived safety, and for those listeners, I haven't, you know, been as active on some social media in the past as I had been in some prior years. But I've been in business 47 years, and from Wall Street to Main Street, and over a course of time, I was fortunate to get to know Bob Chapman, and that's how I got to know Melody, because Bob Chapman, who was the editor of the financial, the international forecaster. Yeah, he is just an awesome guy, and just had a style of presenting his truths that ultimately led him to go offshore and live. And but anyway, Melody was highly recommended to me because of her knowledge and honesty and sincerity about the business, and that's how I got to know Melody some years ago. We've had the chance to visit personally in that, but when Trump was elected, I came somewhat out of semi-retirement, started a company called the VIP Insider, and it's an LLC here in Colorado, and to me, the Insider is my information and my contact capital that I've developed over the last five decades, and the VIPs are businessmen and property owners, which are awesome benefits to be in the United States, and we need to preserve and protect those rights. So I'm using what I've done in the past and helping model different ideas on a platform to complement business owners and complement property owners and complement employees, and want to encourage people to become entrepreneurs if they're not, and enjoy some of those benefits of the entrepreneurship world. So I'm very interested in helping seniors as well. You know, I'm in that category, obviously, and I would like to offer the listenership to engage me, our company, and check out some opportunities being a part-time affiliate with us, just to know the three major things that I just put into a toolkit that I call the Insider's Toolkit, and I've trademarked that name. And It encompasses living your affairs, getting your things in order way before you think you need to in terms of estate planning. It's not a scary word. It doesn't mean you have to have a lot of money, but I want people to know the values of being just a human being relative to a human being being a trustee of their own trust, and that what the trust can do with the other important documents with durable powers of attorney if needed for assets that's outside of trust, healthcare power of attorney, wills, just all those things that are very necessary, because if you're the person that has actually expired and your things are being taken care of through trust, the people's really going to appreciate that. It's going to be your beneficiaries and your spouse. Because I've served so many people that we don't have that much in terms of needing a trust, but, you know, we have things in joint tenancy anyway. Well, let me tell you, folks, when I was doing some massive estate planning back east when I lived back there, the best place for me to prospect was in the probate court, because everything's there. Everything's public. I know who the rich widows were. I know where to send boxes of chocolate. And I groom them in the next 6 to 12 months to become clients of mine. But see, if you did a good job up front, I wouldn't know anything about that, because your stuff would not be in the probate court. So, anyway, it just, I am a paralegal. I've been an estate planning paralegal for 20-some years, and I'm associated with and have been with a number of attorneys, and I know their style, too, and everybody has their place. But attorneys will do their prospecting following rich people around through country clubs and things like that, because if you have things that are commonly under attack or could be, or they need to be disposed of, you commonly think of needing an attorney's services, and they certainly want to be on call. But if you take care of a lot of those things up front for yourself, they're not needed. And so I'm fortunate enough to know a fellow up in Wisconsin. He's named Ron Johnson. And 30-some years ago, I got to know Ron. He has a membership organization specifically for estate planning documents, working with their attorneys that work for their membership members. And the good thing about that is you get the legal assistance and counsel to do everything, but you don't get the billable hours. But you do have the attorney representation, and then the membership backs up the things that they can help you with. And you know, it costs $50 for every 2 years for a membership, and that's all you have to pay. But the trust things are important. Alternative investments are important. Melody's talked many times about what we have going on in the interest rate world and the risk world. We know the stock market's bloated. The majority of trading now, and it makes up of the major stock market indexes, is really done by computers. And it's just a tough world to live in. And so I have some information on how you can become a lender to make the kind of money that the larger hedge funds make. And I'm talking about 8 or 9% a year on your money by knowing how to participate in a commercial lending platform. Another friend of mine, JT McDonald, has an opportunity in the commercial lending space that you and I can put our IRA money or regular money or whatever, if we're looking for the higher yields, which has been chased. For 10 years, we've had, you know, interest rates that are not livable for people that used to have a savings account. And so it's been tough for them. So we have some opportunities through JT's platform called Growth Platforms LLC. And just strangely enough, that's in Wisconsin as well. So, but do connect with Melody or Mean, and because those are important parts of my toolkit. And the third important part is Melody's company, because of her sincerity, honesty, background, and she has huge connections. Because when you're dealing with gold and silver, I want to talk to you guys about keeping your money in order with wills and trusts. I want to talk to you about getting the most for your money if you're looking for income and fixed growth without correlated market risk. But we're talking about return still in the fiat money world, and that's why we need a good hedge with gold and silver to give you insurance on the fiat money, of which we really don't have an option of not to use. So to have a portfolio that's up to date to do what it should be doing for you if needed is always a plus. And the conversations I have with Bob Chapman, he knew like I knew, but he knew it much. He was older than me, but he was just a mentor for me to know. He was there for periodic phone calls and things to let me know what we would call the elites were doing, who actually run the banking systems, and which leads me into a conversation. I'm working on a presentation on the greater dangers for us and the United States is not China. It's not a trade war. Believe it or not, most people think it's a war between Republicans and Democrats right now, but what our biggest problem really is the money system itself through the Federal Reserve. And the Federal Reserve is so misunderstood and probably not even in the vocabulary of most people, knowing that it is a private corporation. So Melanie and I could start a bank, and if we had enough behind us, we could meet with Congress in 1913 and become the creator of the currency for the United States, and then, you know, we've got it made because we are the creators. And what did Rothschild say, Melody? He said, allow me to create and control the currency of a country, and I care not who makes the laws. And that is so true.
It is very true.
Melody, what do you think about cryptocurrency? I have so many people asking me that, and why is that not counterfeiting, you know?
Because it isn't real. It isn't real money. That's why. It's you know, it's digits. You know, that's why you can't say that it's, you know, it's not counterfeiting. It's fake. It's not real. It's digits. And, you know, people don't talk about all the problems that they have with cryptocurrencies. You know, all the problems, you know. And then when you really look at who really uses, where does that big money really come from? Sure, there's investors out there and they buy low, suck it, you know, they suck in and, you know, the markets go up. But what do you think is really used on the dark web? And it is true. You know, it's a sinister type of trade that they buy and sell. You know, pornography and everything else. So my view why do people support something, give them their money so that these other people can do what they do in, whether it be criminal or evil or whatever. I don't get it. You know, why would people support that? Why would you invest in it?
I think everyone has a common first tenet of existence. How are we doing on time, Melody?
15 seconds.
Okay. Well, I was going to get in a little bit more on municipal bonds and a lot of detail about that, but I do have a presentation, Melody, if anyone would like to connect with you, to send me their email address. My site is under some reconstruction, but it's VIPinsiderLLC.com and Rob@VIPinsiderLLC.com. Or just connect with you, Melody. Everybody knows where you're at, okay?
All right. Appreciate it, Rob. Thanks for joining me for these short 20 minutes. Ladies and gentlemen, stay tuned. And so when you come back from our break, you'll be hearing James Corbett and myself from earlier this week. Thank you, ladies and gentlemen, and we'll see you on Monday.
Since the beginning of the United States, kings have sought it. Nations have fought for it. It has been traded, borrowed, purchased, and stolen. There is a reason for it. To secure the blessings of liberty to ourselves and our posterity, invest with the security of gold and silver. Call Discount Gold and Silver Trading at 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. Listen to Financial Survival with your host, Melody Cederstrom, on Shortwave Radio. Visit DiscountGoldAndSilverTrading.net or call 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. For the very best in gold and silver trading, call toll-free 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. Call now.
Melody Cederstrom and CSE Talk Radio team up as Common Sense Voices of Integrity. I personally endorse Melody Cederstrom to be your trusted go-to expert for all your precious metal needs. Experts agree a financial crisis and even collapse is inevitable. Given our government's lack of economic leadership and self-interests of those in power, it's no longer a question of if you should purchase gold and silver, but if you will purchase gold and silver before it's too late. Melody encourages you to tune in each weekday morning. Visit CSE Talk Radio. CommonSenseVoicesOfIntegrity.com. We both agree truth and education are the two significant factors in both our missions. There is a wealth of misinformation out there. Let Melody and Beth Ann help you sort through the chaos and bring you home to the truths that will ensure that you and your family are protected. Call Discount Gold and Silver Trading, 1-800-375-4188, or online at dgscoins.com. Melody and Beth Ann are strong forces together, working to preserve liberty and bring America home.
And welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. You're listening to Financial Survival, and it's brought to you by Discount Gold and Silver Trading. Give us a call at 1-800-375-4188. And yes, I'm always pleased to welcome back to the program James Corbett. And as we all know, and you may know, James is the founder and editor of the Corbett Report, which he founded in 2007. And in 2012, he became the editorial writer for the International Forecaster. And of course, we know it was International Forecaster was created by Bob Chapman. And you can visit James's website at thecorbettreport.com. TheCorbettReport.com. And of course, you can request a complimentary issue of the International Forecaster by going to their website, TheInternationalForecaster.com. TheInternationalForecaster.com. Well, hello, James.
Well, hello, Melody. It's great to be back here with you.
Well, thank you. I always enjoy our conversation. And if time would allow us in the different time zones, I would love to do this on a more frequent basis, but I'm happy to have you here every 2 weeks. And, you know, there's so much that goes on from, you know, during the 2 weeks that we have the time to share. And I don't even know where to begin anymore when we start the programs because there's so much. And, you know, you wrote in the lead into your most recent podcast, we now know that something was a daring special force raid that ended in the death of Osama bin Laden, or is that Abu Musab al-Zarqawi or Baghdadi, or, you know, and some of my customers, when they called me and says, well, how many times can this guy die? This is almost old news. You know, it's a week old. But would you like to comment on that, please?
Yes, I would. Yeah. How many times can the same guy die? Well, I guess it depends on which sources you trust, which is a big part of the whole question. But at any rate, he has been reported as dead, near dead, or maybe dead on at least 4 or 5 different occasions. I actually haven't totaled it up, but I have recounted all of them in my latest podcast. That's episode 366 for those keeping track at home. Something big has happened, where I break down not only the multiple deaths and arrests of the latest terror boogeyman that we were all supposed to be living in mortal fear of, Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi, but also his predecessor, Abu Omar al-Baghdadi, and his predecessor, Abu Musab al-Zarqawi. And although those names just tend to get jumbled up and people just know them as the scary bearded guy that's sometimes posted on the news and announced as dead from time to time, it is instructive to put all of those reports of he was dead at this point, he was dead at this point, he was arrested at this point, he was dead again at this point, he was arrested at this point. Putting all those stories in a row, I think, highlights the absurdity of what it is we're expected to believe in this never-ending war of terror in which it's the 2 minutes hate. All we know is that there's some scary turban bearded guy that's that we're supposed to hate, and oh, he's dead, yay, he's arrested, yay, he's dead again, yay. It's just that sort of thing. And I did point out some of the many parallels between Osama bin Laden and the Obama announcement of OBL's supposed death at the hands of SEAL Team 6 back, what was it, 8 or 9 years ago? I've lost count. And this dramatic raid on Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi's compound. There's a lot of parallels to these stories, not only the daring special forces raid and the watching in the Situation Room photograph that was staged in both of those events, and all of the details. I mean, right down to we tested his DNA before we disposed of his body in the ocean and nobody can see him. I mean, every part of this story is the same as the OBL story, and every part of it stinks to high heaven, just like that one did several years ago. And I think the point of these stories is essentially for politicians to grandstand on the backs of the boogeymen that they themselves have created. And I say that advisedly because, as I point out in that episode 366, both Abu Musab al-Zarqawi, who was the officially acknowledged founder of ISIS, and his replacement, his successor, Abu Omar al-Baghdadi, both of them were, according to the Pentagon itself, either did not exist or were made up characters that were basically played along by the terrorists and by their military / intelligence handlers. The story just gets weirder and weirder the more you dig into it. Long story short, the war of terror is a myth and you shouldn't swallow it.
It just amazes me, James, that, I mean, we see through this, we get it, because we follow it day in, day out for years after years, but the mainstream or the general populace out there are just so buffaloed by this, and it just amazes me that they could be led so easily.
Well, yeah, you're right. And there's two points to make that about that. One is, are they really? I mean, how do we gauge that? We only gauge how much the rest of the population is buffaloed by this by, A, our direct interactions with people around us. And I'm sure we all do know people who do buy this, or at least say they buy this nonsense. But more importantly, we get most of our information from the media itself, who basically implies with everything they say and do, if you don't believe this, you're some kind of fringe nut crazy person. Whereas, time and time again, as I've pointed out before, I did a Propaganda Watch episode recently about polls and the way they are used as a form of propaganda to propagandize us into believing, if you don't believe what we believe, you're crazy. Because look, 93% of the public believes that, and 87% of the public believes this. And if you're one of the 13%, then you're strange. But actually, we find time and time again that actually the majority of the public, the vast majority of the American public, knows that Lee Harvey Oswald was not a lone gunman, lone nut, assassin. And a majority of the public, ever since I think 2006, the polls were coming out showing that the majority of the public believe that the U.S. government is hiding things about 9/11, things like this. But we're still expected to believe that we're crazy if we question such events. So I think part of it is that. And the other part is, as you mentioned, we are looking at this day to day. We are covering this, and we are the people reporting the news. So we're looking at these news feeds every day, and we see these inconsistencies. But the vast majority of people are just working their jobs and getting along with their lives, and they see headlines on the evening news, and it just gets accepted. They just kind of, it washes over them, because most people aren't going to be delving deep into it or keeping a scorecard at home. How many times has this particular terrorist been killed? So that's the value of the work that we're doing, putting these pieces together and showing it to people in a way that the mainstream media will never show it to you.
If propaganda, I mean everything, we can tag it to propaganda, but how does history, I mean, if the truth and reality is overshadowed by all the propaganda, what will our history be?
Yeah.
I mean,
yeah, that's the million-dollar question. And that's one that I addressed quite specifically in my podcast. I can't remember the number off the top of my head, but it's called History is Written by the Winners. And I went through that. Specifically, it was on the heels of my World War I documentary, where I laid out the sort of hidden history of World War I that you never were taught in school, and how that differs from the official story that we're expected to believe. And in that context, I was examining the ways that history is written by the winners, in that case quite literally, how all of these extremely important first-hand official documents of various governments were confiscated and brought back to the U.S. and put in under the auspices of the Hoover Institution, ultimately. And that is, to this day, only a select cadre of researchers, who are obviously establishment mouthpieces for the most part anyway, are allowed to even look at these documents that are the source information for so much of our history of World War I. And to think that our time and the history of our time will be any different, we'd have to be naive. And at some point, a generation or two down the road, when Osama bin Laden and all of this kind of stuff that we've lived through is now out of living memory, our grandchildren will be reading in history textbooks about, oh, and there was this Osama bin Laden. He did this and this, and then he was killed in a special forces raid. And they'll be forced to memorize that and regurgitate it on some test, and like good, dutiful school children. And that will be the extent of it. So it cannot be overstated how important it is to have a truthful historical record so that we can actually base our understanding of the world on something real. Something true for once. Can you imagine if our understanding of the world was based on history and reality and truth, as opposed to this doctored vision of the world that we're fed, that's fed down our throat since the time we're school children, and how much different things could be? I mean, imagine when I was growing up back in the 80s, if they were teaching about what was really happening in MENA, Arkansas, and Iran-Contra and things like that, rather than, you know, just dutifully swallowing the nonsense that was going through the news headlines. Again, we could have a much different understanding of the world. And that is the power and the promise of the independent media that exists to whatever extent that it exists today and is allowed to exist online by the powers that shouldn't be, as much as they may be trying to squelch down on it and tamp that. At any rate, it exists right now. And that's one of the reasons I do what I do, as an historical record, as a witness saying, this is reality, this is what really happened, and hopefully, you know, at least my grandchildren will have some sort of better understanding of the way the world really operates as a result of this.
How far back do you believe? Do you believe World War I was the time that it truly changed? I mean, there's groups out there now that are actually going back and rewriting the history that we believe is true. I mean, there's just no way of knowing, though. I mean, and how far back? I mean, do you go to where the point where history has been rewritten and we don't even know about it?
It's a good question. I would sincerely doubt that there is any time period that you could go back to in the historical record, or at least the historical record that's presented in the mainstream world, as being, this is really the truth in all of its totality. I'm not even sure that would be possible, even if everyone involved was best of intentions trying to document. How do you document everything that's happening in the context and the subtext and put it in a way that summarizes it so that people in the future will be able to understand it? That's probably impossible as a task anyway. But regardless, I can't imagine that there is a time period that there hasn't been some version of history being written by the winners, and that gets handed down. At least with something like World War I, we still have access to enough of the source material and certain things that we can piece together a reliable understanding of what was really happening there and how that influences what's happening today. When you start going further and further back, it becomes more and more spotty and much more difficult to reconstruct a valid and truthful history. So again, I have no doubt that our understanding of the earliest human civilization and the pyramids and all that kind of stuff, I'm sure there are vast inaccuracies in all of that, but it gets much harder to piece together the reality of that. What I tend to try to do is, what can we do with what we have in terms of access to documents and interviews and sources and things, and what can we piece together from that that tells us about the world that we're living in? And on that note, that's exactly why I did the World War I documentary, because there's a few reasons for it. One, it was the 100th anniversary, which has a certain sort of resonance that allows people to sort of take a new look at something like that. But secondarily, because it's far enough back that no one is personally invested in it. No one is like, I fought in that war, so it must have been for the reasons that I thought it was for, or something like that. No one's personally invested in it. But it does have real implications. And I think it was a turning point in the 20th century that, in a way, every major event of the 20th century that comes after it can be traced back to those origins in World War I. And if our understanding of that story is so completely wrong, then our understanding of the 20th century thereby is completely wrong. And we have to reimagine that 20th century in the light of that new information that I hope I presented in the World War I conspiracy, available for free, of course, as with all my work, at CorbettReport.com/WWI.
Thank you for the work that you do, James. Really, it's so important. And, you know, young Americans today, they're losing faith. They're beginning to embrace socialism. There was a new survey YouGov Victims of Communism Memorial Foundation did a survey. 50% of U.S. millennials and 51% of Generation Z have a somewhat or very unfavorable view of capitalism. And meanwhile, they are extremely likely to vote for a candidate who identifies as a socialist. It has doubled. It shows where we're, the direction that this country is headed and the world.
Yeah. And there again, I think that ties back into this whole idea of history and how we understand and internalize it, because this isn't the first time around that socialism has been touted as the political savior or economic savior of the world. But when it was being done back, say, in the 30s, for example, when clearly capitalism had failed because of the Depression, which, of course, was brought about by the banksters, but that's a whole other form of history that we're not taught. But capitalism has failed. What are we going to turn to? In the U.S. and in Canada, technocracy became a big idea there, and there was a big movement around that. Socialism and communism, of course, were ideas that were very much floated around, even in America and other places at that time. And it wasn't until the Grand Disillusionment, all these socialists at that time who had convinced themselves, maybe Stalin and the Soviets, maybe they aren't doing it in the best possible way, but they're good-hearted and best of intentions, and they had their wake-up call eventually after 10, 20, 30 years of watching the Soviet Union and what it became, of realizing, oh, this isn't this, this great utopia that we had been promised. So, a lot of people got disillusioned with that. And people like Orwell, for example, got very disillusioned with the way that socialism had progressed and what it really represented, and started writing warnings, essentially, about those types of totalitarian systems. And that history gets lost, and so now we have another young generation growing up who's never experienced this, doesn't understand it from that perspective, who are going to have to go through the exact same thing again and again and again, which is the exact basis of that old phrase, history, if you don't know history, you're doomed to repeat it.
Do you still follow Canadian news? What's happening up there? We saw that Trudeau that was promised support if he rolls out the universal drug plan. Did you follow any of that?
I must confess that I do not follow the Canadian politics day to day. Being in Japan, it really doesn't affect me. Being a long-term resident of Japan, it doesn't affect me. So I only get it through relatives and friends I have back home. But certainly with the next 4 years of Trudeau, I'm not looking for any change in the status quo, of course. But then again, it's not that the people he was running against would have been a radical change in the status quo, at least in terms of Canada's foreign policy.
All right, we're going to stop here, folks. We'll be right back right after these few short messages.
Just one more time. Oh, won't you tell me again? Oh, can you feel it? Oh, won't you tell me again?
Food prices have increased over 40%. Energy prices have increased over 20%. Wheat and gas prices have increased over 70%. What's going to be next? Do you see these trends reversing or even stabilizing? All fiat currencies have always failed and collapsed their economies on their way down. The Roman Empire, China, France, Argentina, Finland, Mexico, Russia, Zimbabwe all tried fiat currency and all collapsed into chaos. Meanwhile, the dollar has lost over 97% of its gold value since 1971, when an ounce of gold was valued at $35. If your assets are in paper, you are in danger. Protect your assets with gold and silver. Visit Discount Gold and Silver Trading at DGScoins.com. That's DGScoins.com, or call 1-800-375-4188. That's 800-375-4188. Protect yourself and your family.
We all know that Berkey Water Purification Systems are the most trusted name in water filtration. As an authorized Berkey dealer for over 6 years and serving thousands of satisfied customers, the Berkey Guy offers amazing specials for Berkey Water Filtration Systems. The Berkey Light Systems include a set of self-sterilizing and recleanable black purification elements that purify water by removing chlorine, pathogenic bacteria, cysts, and parasites to non-detectable levels and remove harmful chemicals such as herbicides and pesticides. Order the Berkey Light System today. today, complete with two black Berkey elements for only $231, and the Berkey Guy will ship your order free of charge. With the purchase of a Berkey Light, the Berkey Guy is also offering a set of fluoride and arsenic filters for only $39.99. That's over 30% off the retail price. Call the Berkey Guy at 1-877-886-3653. That's 1-877-886-3653. Or order online at GoBerkey.com. That's GoBerkey.com today.
And welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. You're listening to Financial Survival. I'm Melody Cedarstrom, and I'm here with my guest, James Corbett, the founder and editor of the Corbett Report. And let's see where we want to start, James. How about what QE4 means for you? You wrote in a recent newsletter that the Federal Reserve has admitted that it's beginning its fourth round of so-called quantitative easing since the Lehman collapse over a decade ago. And you referred to it as QE4, except the Fed isn't calling it that. And so we've been talking about this a lot, and maybe you can share with the listeners what your take is on it.
Well, I don't think it'll be surprising to any of your listeners, but essentially this is a rigged game, and it is being the can is being kicked or attempted to be kicked yet again, which again shouldn't be a surprise, I think, to your regular listeners. But of course, people may have seen the headlines this week about the S&P 500 closing at another record as corporate earnings beat expectations. Yay! I guess everything's peachy keen in the economy. Wait, what? The latest Q2 results are 1.9% GDP growth? Yeah. That's contracting rather quickly, isn't it? What's going on? Well, I note this very interesting story that came out at MarketWatch just the other day. Why would the Fed cut interest rates a third time in a row, even as stocks near records? Investors may soon find out. And it's talking about the Federal Open Market Committee, which will be meeting, I believe, next week to determine whether or not there will be a third rate cut in a row from the Fed.
It was today. They cut it a quarter point, yeah.
There you go. All right. Well, there you exactly.
Well, again, Wednesday. Wednesday they cut it.
It's just nonsense, isn't it? Essentially this article that goes through exactly how this information that is coming from the Fed on high, the interest rate information, which sets ultimately the tone of the economy in general, is essentially a decision that is being made by a handful of bankster insiders. And that's what the economy is teetering on, and whether investors are pricing in a rate cut or not, and all of this. Essentially betting on what the banksters want to happen in the economy is what the markets have ultimately ended up being. And this is a great example of it, because of course investors have already priced in the third rate cut, so the Fed had to do it, right? Just nonsense. And this is, I think, the underlying sort of nonsense that we see when we see through QE4, which, by the way, don't call it quantitative easing, according to Jerome Powell, who said this is not QE, in no sense is this QE, last month when they were announcing, on the exact same day that they were announcing, or was it earlier this month, that they were announcing that they were going to be pumping in hundreds of billions of dollars, potentially trillions of dollars more, into the markets in the form of buying securities, which of course is the very definition of quantitative easing. Ballooning the Fed's balance books with securities is exactly what quantitative easing 1, 2, and 3 were all about. But now, don't call it QE. This is not QE. Well, of course it is QE. And I was just pointing out in that article that I wrote some of the interesting ways this connects in with other information we've been getting about the economy lately, including a post on the Dutch Central Bank's website that notes, if the system collapses, the gold stock can serve as a basis to build it up again, which is very true, but it's very interesting to see that coming from a central bank, when you think that they are the ones that are generally poo-pooing, oh, gold, that's a 19th century idea. We don't need that anymore. We're the 21st century. And of course, that's the way that Mark Carney was painting things recently, where he was warning also about an economic collapse/reset. And he was saying that basically the government, the central banks have painted themselves into a corner because they want to pin everything to the dollar, but the dollar itself can't be devalued because it is the reserve currency. So the debt bubble that they've been blowing for well, at least since the 70s, when the gold was dollar was taken off the gold standard, can't really be blown effectively anymore to devalue the currency so that other currencies can rise against it. They can't do that anymore. So they need to find a new peg. And Mark Carney threw out there not only precious metals, but hey, how about something like Libra? And he actually did mention Libra specifically in his speech as outgoing Bank of England governor, pimping this Facebook scam coin, essentially, is what it is, as a potential digital currency that could be the peg that everything will be pegged to in the future. Nonsense, of course, because once again, look at what the central banks are doing more so than what they're saying or pimping, and you will see that they have been on a record gold buying spree. Specifically, last August, there was a gold buying frenzy that added nearly 60 tons to the reserves of just China, Russia, Turkey, and Qatar alone. And that gold, central gold bank holdings generally rose to a half-century high last year, with no signs of that dropping off. So I think the writing is on the wall. And as usual, I think the people who are in charge of the system want you to look one direction while they go a different direction.
Yeah, and it's the same game they play. You think people would learn after a period of time, but again, it's just one of these things. Everything's good, happy if you're told you know, that it is. You begin to believe it, or you want to believe it, and you ignore everything else. You, common sense goes right out the door.
Exactly.
And it's amazing how they would say the Libra. Do you think there's a particular reason why Christine Lagarde is taking over Draghi's position? Do you think that's a maybe something a little more to read into that than, you know, that perhaps we are a little bit closer to, you know, whatever you want to call it, the reset or the collapse of the system or whatever?
I don't know if that is necessarily a signal of an impending collapse, but I do think Lagarde was flown in there to the ECB from her position at the IMF because she has been proven over the years to be a good, reliable puppet for the bankers and to do their bidding, as she did in her role as managing director of the IMF. And let's not forget, she does actually have a criminal record. She was convicted of criminal charges over massive government payouts back in the day, back in 2016. So I think that's a little bit of extra leverage that they have over her, I would imagine. Anyway, certainly I don't, it's not going to be a drastic change from Draghi over to Lagarde. I think it's just a continuation of policies that have existed. I'm not expecting that she's going to handle the ECB or its attempts to contain the Eurozone dumpster fire any differently than Draghi did.
Well, you know, there's two things I want to finish up the segment with. We wanted to continue from the last conversation, meeting a friend that you had written about. And I don't know if we have time for both, so I'll talk quick here. How to worship government. I'm going to let you choose. Or do you think you can get comments on both?
And maybe. Well, let's start with the friend.
Yes. That's important to me because I told you during the break, you know, over the, you know, almost 25 years doing this, you meet a lot of people over the phone. You don't ever meet them, but I call them my friends without
ever
meeting them.
It's such a simple point and one that most people will think is just a truism and not that interesting, but actually it really is interesting when you contemplate it and when you stare it face to face, which is the occasion upon which I wrote this editorial, upon meeting a friend for the first time, in reference to my friend and someone that I've been collaborating with for a decade now, James Evan Pilato over at New World Next, over at MediaMonarchy.com, and we do the New World Next Week, a weekly series. We examine three news stories and dissect them. And we've been doing this for a decade now, 10 years. And so he came to Japan on the occasion of the 10th anniversary so that we could have a real-life meetup. We've been talking about it for years and years. We should meet in real life sometime. Well, he actually came to Japan, and we did it for the first time. So here I am in the position of meeting someone that I have been talking to week in and week out for a decade now. I talk to him more than I talk to my family back home in Canada. and yet, we've never actually met in face-to-face in person. So the way I frame this in the editorial, I talk about a bet that I had with QuarterReport.com video editor Brock West, we were both betting, because neither of us have met James in real life, so we were both betting, well, how tall do you think he is? And I thought, oh, that's it's a fascinating question, because I only see what people see when they're watching New World Next Week, the upper third of him framed in the webcam shot. I've never seen him, so I don't know. I have no idea. Is he a really tall guy? Is he short? Is he average size? I don't know. So we had a little bet about that, and I won't reveal how tall James Empolada really is, because that's actually kind of the point of the editorial, that you can be friends with someone you've never actually physically met before is not necessarily completely a 21st century concept. As I note in the editorial, pen pals and other such things have existed throughout the ages, but certainly not to the extent that it does today, where people are have colleagues and friends and are doing hookups and things with people online that they have never met in personal reality, physical meat space, as it's called. It's crazy, and it raises questions about friendship and what kind of community can really be formed online. I think there is a possibility to form some form of community. The listeners of this program, for example, it is a type of community, but how far can we stretch that analogy, and where does that begin to break? And I think there is a difference between communication online, usually in the form of anonymous comments and that sort of thing, versus actually talking to people in real life. And I provide some examples of that in the editorial of times that I've encountered, and I'm sure everyone has, where seemingly minor things become major points of contention and are blown out of proportion. Whereas in reality, if you were talking face to face with someone, they probably wouldn't even come up as points at all. Or if they were, they would just be instantly swept aside because they're not that important. But online, in this anonymous environment, it does shape a different form of communication. And what does that portend for society generally? That's the big question, because, as again, I don't think I have to go far out on a limb here. I think everyone can experience this. Society does seem to be breaking down and breaking apart, and people, the space between people is growing larger, even as we're 100% 24/7 online connected with everyone, and we can be talking to people all around the world, but are we really talking to them? This isn't such a philosophical, abstract question as it is becoming a real part of our daily lives, and what does it mean to have interactions with people you never actually meet?
Well, you know, I was just, you know, it is fascinating because to some degree you think, well, it's good, but then when you see the how far apart we're becoming, I mean, because people can have relationships and form bonds, you know, and gives them a larger arena, mm-hmm, or venue to do that.
We wouldn't be talking right now if it wasn't for this very phenomenon.
True.
And I wouldn't be able to say, oh, I know Melody Cedarstrom, if it wasn't for this forum. But then again, have I ever met Melody Cedarstrom? No, I have not. So what does it know? Do I really know Melody? Does she know me? In what way? Again, I think it is an important question. And precisely because, as you say, the space between people in real life is becoming larger. And that's actually something that we covered on New World Next Week recently, with a poll showing that a growing number of, I believe it was Americans specifically, are taking their smartphone to bed. And I can't remember the percentage, but it was a disturbingly large percentage of people said that the last thing that they see at night is their smartphone screen, not their partner. And that is becoming an increasing part of the way people are living their lives. And what does that mean? That our actual real life physical connection with people in our lives, our family, people who live in our house, is becoming even more distant than these strangers on the internet.
Easy to replace them with some sort of robot, right?
Now you're getting into the... Yes, I think this is really part of the long-term agenda, that we are being steeped into an environment where the human bonds are breaking down, and they will be replaced by the technological equivalent, right? Equivalent in quotation marks, because of course it is no substitute for real human connection, but at a certain point down the line, there will be a generation that grows up that doesn't really know what actual real human connection is supposed to be like. How do people really interact when they're not surrounded by all these devices that are squawking at them, or, you know, robotic AI that's listening into all their conversations? What is it like to have real human contact? And that, we remember, before these devices were everywhere and always on and always there with us, we remember that and at least have that connection to it. But, you know, children, our children's children, and it becomes one of those kinds of questions, which, again, has such huge ramifications for the future.
I watched The Twilight Zone when I was a child, But I never thought I would be living in it.
You know, that's a great way to put it. Yeah.
We got a few minutes left, and how to worship government is your recent article on thecorbettreport.com. And I'm going to let you just talk about that because there was a quotation from the TV and evangelist Pat Robertson about President Trump. The President of the United States is in danger of losing the mandate of heaven, and that was due to the Syria pullout of troops that he announced a couple of weeks ago.
Yeah. I mean, how dare the U.S. think about leaving a country rather than invading a country, and that would cause Trump to lose the mandate of heaven, which is an old Chinese concept. Basically, the emperor rules, is allowed to rule by heaven. Heaven appoints the emperor, essentially, and he is allowed to rule so long as he maintains his virtue. But when he loses his virtue, he loses the mandate of heaven, and that's when you start getting riots and uprisings and floods and droughts and all sorts of bad things happen, and that's a sign, oh, the emperor has lost the mandate of heaven, so let's replace the emperor. And that was the way it worked, you know, in ancient China. And that is at least the reference that Pat Robertson is making there, whether he really knows about that in depth or not. And I thought that was interesting precisely because that comes at the exact time, just this past week in Japan, we had the new emperor here formally proclaiming his accession to the chrysanthemum throne. And you have to see some of the pictures or footage of this to understand it, but it's just craziness. It looks like something from thousands of years ago. It's essentially this emperor on this dais, 6 meters up above the people who are throwing their hands up in essentially in worship of this emperor, who, by the way, is supposedly literally descended from the gods. That's at least the story that the Japanese public have been fed for a very long time. So I thought there was a lot of that swirling around to let us look at that idea once again, that government worship is something real. There is something to this idea of statism as a religion, and I think that's well, obviously, I have my opinions about that. I hope people will read the article to find out about it.
Visit thecorbettreport.com, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you, James, and as always, we don't have enough time, and we'll be back on Monday, so until then, be safe, good night, and God bless.